Welcome to Unfrozen. This is episode 107, Insurrection, and my name is Dan Zafarik.
I'm Greg Lindsay, and yes, as you know, from time to time here at Unfrozen, we delve into the broader political and social issues around the built environment. Back in episode 105, of course, we talked about making Gaza great again, and 104, and of course, with the peace plan now in place in Palestine, and with perhaps the end of that conflict at hand, we'll see exactly how much of that plan gets implemented and to what degree. But at the moment, today's episode is dealing with, of course, the U.S. military at home. And, of course, the fact that we have seen masked ICE agents are currently, well, they are abducting people off the streets of Chicago, where Dan lives. They are storming apartment buildings with Black Hawk helicopters while the Secretary of Homeland Security looks on. There are National Guard troops in Portland, Oregon, and governors across the United States, including Governor Pritzker of Illinois and Governor Newsom of California, are calling for some sort of intervention, planning to quit the Association of Governors now that the United States National Guard is being weaponized against itself or against other states. It's a lot. It's a huge backdrop. And looming over it all, of course, is President Trump's rumination that he may invoke the Insurrection Act, which would allow effectively the president to send in at his own discretion regular forces, regular armed forces into American cities, which, of course, has, we could discuss the legalities here, but standards such as posse comitatus and others have prevented American presidents from doing that. So what happens next? What happens if we actually see U.S. Army troops inside of cities? Well, our guest today has imagined exactly that. Jason Tester is a professional foresight practitioner. I know Jason from his time at the Institute for the Future. In January, before Inauguration Day, Jason published Insurrection, an American Future, incredibly photo-detailed rumination about what would happen if the Insurrection Act was called and U.S. troops were sent into San Francisco to occupy it. And so here to talk to us today about civic foresight, about insurrection, about what happens next for America's cities, we're excited to have you. So welcome, Jason.
Thanks. Great to be here. Thanks
well, for all right, me. Jason, I guess as a starting point for our listeners here. So you are not an architect. You are not an urbanist. You are a professional foresight practitioner. What led you, other than everything, to create Insurrection? What in particular thought you would lead to this particular moment? And how much do you think this particular moment has aligned with your vision from 10 months ago? It seems fairly prescient to me.
Yeah. Where do I start? One way I enter this is I don't think I have the most practical skill set in the world. You know, I'm a futurist, right? I'm a strategic futurist. I'm good at looking at signals of change. I'm good at finding patterns. I'm good at helping people and groups understand what's happening. You know, in a zombie apocalypse, I'd be the first. I'd last a week, right? But one thing I'm particularly good at, one thing I have a knack for that I've honed over 20 years is telling stories about the future, and particularly trying to create visions of the future that feel so realistic that you really can suspend your disbelief that this is not real, that this is, hypothetical, and actually just engage with the content, engage with the story, and with the predictions. It's summer last year. It's August, and President Trump is already the nominee. But even before that, while he was out of office, he made a lot of surprisingly direct, unambiguous threats and pledges that if he were reelected, he would readily send troops into American cities to combat crime, to quell. To combat the hellscape that he says all cities are, to quell protests. I have used the word quell more in the last 10 months than my entire life. And it was just, it would be something that he and his administration would be really willing to do. And we saw some of the groundwork also laid in Project 2025. And so there was there was just all these weak signals. I mean, you know, again, going back to being a futurist, there were all these signals of that this, you know, he makes a lot of pledges, he makes a lot of threats, but this one just felt, and specifically, he calls out San Francisco all the time at any given list, any given chance to name cities or, you know, give a list of cities. San Francisco is right up there. And actually the last time he did it, which I think was at the gathering of generals, San Francisco was the very first city on his list where we're going next. So anyway, that's the backstory. And I was worried. I was like, why aren't more people talking about this? Why it's, I understand that it's one threat among many. It's kind of nebulous. It's difficult to imagine. We don't want to imagine it. But I just thought someone should imagine it. So I started to work on this scenario. It started off, honestly, with just a few, one or two images of troops in front of the Painted Ladies in Alamo Square, right? The iconic Victorian houses of San Francisco. And then it grew from there into like, here's a provocative postcard of what that might look like. And it grew into a full-fledged scenario, full-fledged story from beginning, from how it might start to how it might end, or at least, you know, kind of an apex of it.
We'll include, of course, a link to the story itself, to Insurrection, in the show notes. But Jason, our listeners who have not had a chance to look at it yet or to choose to listen to this first, what's the thumbnail description of the story? Please lay out the events that happen in Insurrection.
Sure. Well, the way I started is I say, you know, this could be next year, next month, or next week. And it's really, as I say, you know, any moment of any opportunity of any sign of civil unrest, that even if local authorities quickly get it under control, which in my story they do, I hypothesize that this administration would jump at the chance to send in troops on the, you know, even for the flimsiest, the barest of pretenses for sending in troops. And so that's how the story starts, is there's it could be a World Series victory. It could be just a standard, you know, it could be standard protests. I mean, you know, anything could give that national impression, that viral impression of a city in chaos, no matter how quickly the flames get extinguished, right? And from there it rolls on. He announces that he's sending troops into San Francisco, a massive protest march, the largest in San Francisco history, which I think I peg at 150,000, because in the Vietnam War we had about 100,000. You know, it gathers, and then that leads to that's the flashpoint. You know, you have these troops sent in to combat the image of chaos. You have this massive protest march, you know, mobilized on a moment's notice to meet it. And of course, and I'm surprised we haven't seen this yet in reality, something goes wrong. The troops, you know, one troop fires on protesters and it goes downhill from there. And from there, it becomes it becomes a larger operation. I call it Operation Golden Glory, which is the military's plan to stay embed in San Francisco. I'm not sure if I use the word occupation, but it's effectively that, an occupation, to aid in the deportation campaign, to quell any protests, any pockets of protests that might emerge in response to these troops coming into San Francisco, right? Kind of this feedback loop. And really just to assert federal authority, to assert dominance in a city that does not, where President Trump is not popular, right? And from there, the story doesn't play out chronologically or linearly necessarily. I jump around, really inspired by photojournalism, in the two projects I've done this year. And so basically in this story, photojournalists are sent out around the city to document this the presence of troops, to shadow them, to confront them, to document the aftermath, to document what they're doing. And it's everything from a mistaken raid on a house, and we see the aftermath. We see a house, the debris, a toddler sitting crying as troops stand outside, almost laughing, callously cackling. We see a drag queen in the Castro being arrested at a satirical drag protest. One of my, perhaps my favorite image, we see a, for those that don't know, there's a drag queen troupe called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, for 40, 50 years old, I think, rooted in San Francisco. And we see a soldier who is going, who is has moral, ethical issues with this, with deployment, his orders, actually getting a drag makeover from one of the sisters to avoid facial recognition cameras, to more easily, go AWOL and evade military arrest by the military police. So it's a series of 15 vignettes across San Francisco. And, you know, many of them broadly applicable to all American cities, any American city where we've seen or we could potentially or have seen a deployment, but also some like the queerness, like the drag story, some, you know, kind of rooted in San Francisco. And it ends on a climax. It ends on an unknown note. The protesters, the resistance forces, have started to get the upper hand. They're jamming communication networks of the troops. And I'll spoil it. We see a woman holding up one of our newer guerrilla underground alternative flags of San Francisco, illuminated from the back by flames and explosions, right, happening on the protests around her. And we don't know where it goes from there. I just deliberately end. We don't know, just like we don't know where these occupations, these deployments are going. The story doesn't know where it's going.
Well, I think we'll unpack some of the elements of the story because there's so much rich detail in here that has echoes in what's actually happening there. I mean, you have drag queens in the story, but I think of the frogs costumes in Portland and others who are returning to whimsy as there. But first, about the method, and again, I would encourage listeners to look at it because it's fascinating because it has the telltale, unmistakable aesthetic of generative AI, and yet it's at a higher quality than any AI slop that I've ever seen. So obviously, you did some sort of retouching on it. I would love you to talk about the method of how you told the story there too, because it is sort of, it is photorealistic, but again, it's you can tell it's obviously AI generated just at a level of, I mean, all the words are spelled correctly. I think that's like the first giveaway. But yeah, how did you create it?
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly, I have been, my career has been as professional futurist, but also as a practitioner of speculative design. I've been practicing speculative design since grad school. I went to grad school for human computer interaction, and halfway through I realized all I want to do is be a futurist. I don't actually care about ergonomics or usability. I want to be a futurist. I want to tell big picture stories. And so I've been doing it since my thesis in grad school, this practice of speculative design. And over my career, I've made probably 300, let's say, images, artifacts, visuals, little pieces of ephemera from the future, right? Primarily visual. I'm particularly good at visual, and I think visuals can be really impactful. And generative AI has just changed that game entirely. I mean, in 2004, right? When, let's say, I wanted to make an image of a folding phone. Let's say, right? I would have actually in 2004, I would have built that folding phone, an industrial design form factor of it, and spent a week or two or three or four in Photoshop then trying to get it right. Or maybe actually trying to mock it up in person, little holographic things floating on that industrial design. Generative AI, just this, and we're still reckoning with this, what this ability to prototype the future, I'm still processing it. I mean, day by day, that ability gets so much better and the implications are huge. I mean, that anyone can tell a story about the future. Okay, so I'm rambling a little bit, but yes. So the process starts with generative AI, but as you said, I don't want anyone, and I made this project with haters in mind. I made this project to convince those who might not believe this was feasible. To convince those who might not think that an occupation, a deployment of troops would be a bad thing. I wanted to show them another side. I wanted to be persuasive. I wanted to be credible. And so when I see you know, in like an upside down house or a line that goes into nowhere, you know, that ruins it for me. And so I certainly can imagine that, you know, anyone who would want to critique this work can jump and say, well, that, you know, that line goes nowhere. You know, this is clearly AI slop. So long story short, it's hours and hours and hours of generative AI to get the base image right. And then dozens and dozens and dozens of hours in Photoshop to refine and refine and refine and refine. And actually, I don't know how detailed you want to get into this, but as the tools, even since I started that last year, the tools have changed so dramatically that in short, basically what I'm trying to say is that what I mentioned earlier, this ability to prototype things that our minds can have, you know, are hard for us to conceive, right? Whether that's technology, whether that's social change, whatever, you know, alternative presence or possible futures that we might want to prototype, we can do it like that right now. And as someone who's been doing this for 20 years, using every tool possible to, you know, to build something so refined that it gets the audience to suspend their disbelief and focus on the content, this is, you know, mind blown. And I'm still, you know, like I said, I'm a kid in a candy store, basically, working on this.
I'm wondering if you are concerned about the realism that you have depicted here and how close it actually now parallels reality, even closer than when it was originally posted, which, you know, it definitely didn't seem far off even then, and now it's, you know, even closer to reality. Are you concerned about people picking up these images, which are definitely more skillfully rendered than your typical AI depictions, and trying to pass them off as actual news? I know within the boundaries of the site, you've been very careful to say, this is fiction, and here are my sources, and this is how I did it. But, you know, images are pretty easy to rip off on the internet. So I'm wondering if you've seen any evidence of people repurposing it anywhere else where it probably shouldn't be.
I haven't seen evidence of that. I actually just last week, a friend told me that he showed the site to someone who has a background in both media and journalism. And her first question to him is, when did I follow the news pretty closely. When did I miss troops in San Francisco? I thought, you know, I've been following this. When did that happen? So, you know, it is a very delicate balance between creating something that is real enough that people will engage in the content, will take it seriously, will have an emotional, visceral impact that they say, okay, I believe this could happen. What do we do? Right? You have to get to that level. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to go too much farther past that. I used to say, I would have answered that question differently 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I used to talk about a moment of constructive confusion in doing what I do in these artifacts from the future, in speculative design, right? That I wanted someone to look at something, perhaps like, you know, embedded on a telephone pole in the real world, not just, you know, in a page in a report. I wanted them to look at it and in that be confused for a moment, like, this looks real. Most things we encounter in the world are real, right? So, you know, the default is to assume something's real, but, you know, gene editing pop-up shop in the Mission, you know, I haven't heard of, is that really possible? You know, and so I used to think that in that moment of confusion, that brief moment of confusion where they're trying to figure out if it's real, it's enough for them to take, to consider the ideas in a way that a report, any other format would not have broken through and gotten them to deal with that, to process that. With this project, I don't know. To be honest, this is my first foray into politics. This is my first foray into current events. My background is largely, you know, from being a professional futurist, my background is largely in, you know, prototyping new technologies, prototyping new impacts of technology on society, or even new consumer packaged goods, right? So this is my first foray into politics and current events, and I don't want that. I don't want constructive confusion. I don't want confusion to be a part of this anymore. I want it to be powerful enough that they go into it eyes open, knowing what it is, full transparency, and the story itself, you know, is so impactful, so emotional, powerful, that they can know it's fake and still be swept away and still consider what the message and the possibilities, what this means for their life and their.
Well, that raises the question, yeah, Jason, who is the audience for this? Because, you know, most professional foresight practitioners, like architects, are doing client work on behalf of mostly corporations, occasionally governments. I was just in Vancouver last week at World City and ran to Alana Lipset, who I believe was a colleague of yours at IFTF back in the day, and she and Jake Dunnigan, still of IFTF, do work for the U.S. Conference of Mayors, et cetera. But yeah, you made this yourself, so who do you hope will see this, and what is your theory of change with regards to, like, freelance foresight?
Yeah. you know, so the project has had different goals, I think. You know, when I published this on, let's say, January 5th, I think it was early January, before the inauguration. For some reason, I really felt like I had to get this out before the inauguration or else no one will pay attention. I don't know why, but I had to put that pressure on myself. So I published it then. And, you know, at that point, the goal was just to get anyone to consider to grapple with the fact, to spend a moment considering this person who is about to be our next president and in charge of the entire apparatus of the federal government, has threatened to do this many, 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 many times. Like when there's, you know, when there's enough smoke, there's fire, right? And this is, he was going to do this. I just want anyone to take this seriously, whether it be the citizen, a voter on the street, a person on the street, a neighbor on the street, a policymaker, anyone, to just consider, grapple with this possibility. And I'll be radically honest here. I sent out the announcement in January to a lot of friends and colleagues and acquaintances and people, other speculative designers, other futurists, and I got great feedback. But it didn't, this was early January, right? January 21st, DEI was canceled. January 22nd, Doge happened, right? It got a little lost. It got a little lost. I even heard from one editor at a news site, like, saying that this is not going to happen. Like, this is good. This is great. It's just, it's not going to happen. It's not one of our major top threats to democracy right now. And then fast forward to June, I forget which day in June, LA happens, right? And then this the entire meaning of this project changes. It's no longer about trying to convince people that this is could happen, right? What this would look like if it happened, this vague, nebulous threat. It's now more about, well, you're catching me, like, you know, right at the cusp of this transition, right? I'm not entirely sure what the goal is at this point. I mean, I think one goal is certainly to convince my neighbors here in San Francisco that what this might look like. You know, what does it look like to have troop carriers coming across the Golden Gate Bridge? What does it look like to have protesters in the Mission, which is going to be a hotbed of protest when troops come here? What is that going to look like? What is it going to look like when our neighbors are arrested, when troops are going on immigration raids, right, in our immigrant communities here? So now maybe my goal has, my audience has changed a little bit. It's a little more local. You know, I am certainly, I want to keep doing more work like this. I've created a follow-up project. I'm not sure if we're going to talk about that. But certainly, you know, having this one, how do I say it, kind of in the bag, you know, that as we would sometimes joke as futurists, you know, nailed that, you know, that I, if that establishes credibility that there is not only power in these individual speculations, these individual projects, but also there's power in this new methodology, in this new methodology of speculative activism, of bringing what if design and what if conversations and long-term horizons to our policy discussions, to our political discussions, which is really, that's my big goal here. It's not, you know, I wanted people to think about troops in cities, and I still want people to think about troops in San Francisco, right? But I want to change our political discourse, to actually maybe to elevate it, to be more about, let's have competing visions of the future. Let's have competing, you know, grounded, credible, competing visions of the future. And let's have our discussion of politics and policy there, not just at the, you know, schoolyard name calling, you know, the typical, you know, red blue left right fights that we have today. Can we elevate that discussion into the longer term?
Well, getting to unreality, I'll hand it back to Dan in a second, but I do want to ask about one particular vignette in Insurrection, which is, to me, the most chilling image personally is the open air detention camp in Dolores Park. Which is labeled the Civic Processing Center. I'll just read from the text quickly. Hundreds of arrested protesters are held in a makeshift detention center quickly erected in Dolores Park. Detainees report being subjected to biometric scans and extensive photographing, sparking fears of a permanent federal registry targeting dissenters, a digital blacklist. I was hoping you could talk a bit about the real world antecedents of this and what this might look like, given that, just for example, when I was in Vancouver for World City, I talked about how the Meta Ray-Bans and a lot of the new wearable technologies, AI, friend.ai, and these other wearable technologies, of course, can be used to capture this. And then we see Doge, and we see Palantir has been given a $30 million contract by ICE to create Immigration OS. We can see this integration. How do you, I guess the question is, what is this based on? And how do you explain these immaterial digital technologies and how they might manifest in the future? I find the hardest thing to explain to people is not what it might look like with troops in the streets, but how all of this gets joined. I feel like no one really understood what Doge was doing, for example, and how these technologies get meaningfully joined together. So what were you thinking there when you thought about the digital blacklist?
I think the weak signals, again, you know, going back, you know, the way I do this process is I still do it. I consider myself a researcher first. I want everything to be grounded. I want everything to be rooted in, you know, in something that is some analysis that's happened, some early signals that we're seeing. And, you know, we are, I mean, you know, of course, when people are arrested now, they are subject to collection of their DNA. They are subject to complete biometric, biometric capturing of their biometric data, right? There's everything from their contours of their face to their stride, to their gait, right? And you know, it would be fascinating to see as a next, you know, kind of a little bit of Minority Report style, you know, just where you know everything flashes your eyeballs. What does it look like when we have a China style full pervasive surveillance system, right? In America. And I don't think anyone would doubt that it's coming. Maybe it's top down. It might be more piecemeal. It might be more corporate, commercial. But yeah, I mean, that would be a great way to play that out. And we can certainly people who are arrested for protesting, for dissenting in 2025, in this climate, you know, they're considered enemies of the state already there. I mean, they're labeled as such. So, you know, is anyone in any position of authority going to have any problems, you know, worried about their rights, worried about collecting illegal data, collecting, you know, going beyond and above in terms of how these people are processed and treated? No, I don't think so. So that was kind of the basis for it.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting to me because I think, to me, it's extremely anti-urban. I mean, the anonymity of urban life is one of its key attributes. That's what makes a city different from a village. And I just think people have a hard time grappling with the notion of, I think most of us exist in a state of privacy through obscurity, but the idea that there's no more obscurity at all because of the ability of these technologies, what does that mean for urban life when everything is observable, recreatable, et cetera there? But Dan, I've been hoarding the conversation.
Oh, not at all. I was just trying to think of a way to sort of relate this again to physical space and urban design, and you've kind of provided a segue for it there. I was thinking as you were describing this scenario, and you mentioned China. You know, I lived in China for 2 years, from 15 to 17, and already at that point, it was very common to see overhead gantries along every road that would photograph every license plate all day long. And I assume that eventually they probably augmented these gantries and other, there's just a bunch of surveillance technology everywhere on every light post, every building. Ostensibly they were there to determine whether people were driving on the anti-smog days. They had to use alternate license plates in some cases to try to reduce smog. And if you drove on a day where you were not supposed to drive, you would get a ticket or something. But of course, they were flashing all day long and taking pictures, just generally observing. So, I mean, this infrastructure has existed for some time. Would you foresee that in the medium term, that something like this might be installed in the U.S., maybe even in an even less obvious way? At least in China, I can say it was pretty obvious that you were being surveilled, and there was nothing you could do about it, so nobody acted up in public. And maybe it was the presence of that possibly non-functional infrastructure that guided behavior. But I guess I'm curious about how, I'm just trying to picture how this would go down in our society, where the private sector is stronger, has more insidious technology, and the federal government is very haphazard in terms of how it implements things, even if they are terrifying. It's difficult to imagine. Well, maybe I shouldn't say it's difficult to imagine, because all of this would have been difficult to imagine 5 or 6 years ago. I guess my question is, what comes next? In terms of the surveillance technology and things besides troops kind of showing up and randomly, battering people and just generally creating an atmosphere of terror. What's the more permanent infrastructure of this control system? I guess that's the question.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but don't we see after a major event, after a Super Bowl, after a convention, the security technologies that are put into place for that event, for that ostensibly for that one time event, they stay as part of the infrastructure of those host cities, as far as I understand, right? That is certainly one mechanism by which we're seeing this special event, the Super Bowl, the All-Star Game, right? And we see always on surveillance cameras installed, they don't go away when the crowds leave, when the backup police leave, when the attention goes away. A lot of the infrastructure stays there. I think that is certainly one mechanism by which we're seeing this. My other thought was, as you were talking, I've been thinking about San Francisco. And you think, given our history, given our countercultural history, given our San Francisco values, that we would be opposed to a lot of this. And yet, three examples came immediately off the top of my head. There's a city in the North Bay, a very wealthy, small enclave, with only, I think, two roads going in and into the city, right? And they were the first city, as I understand it, in the country to actually capture the license plate of every single car that entered and left, in part because it was so easy, because they only had two roads, right? Because it was so easy to do that. I'm thinking about a ballot initiative that we had last year, 2 years ago here in San Francisco, primarily around police technology, primarily around The use of buying drones for the police force, giving police the permission to use drones more liberally in San Francisco, and to install cameras, to install always on surveillance cameras. And it passed. I mean, you know, crime in San Francisco is a complex story that, you know, it's a side tangent, but a measure like that passed by a wide margin, right? And so we now have these new, you know, San Franciscans were willing to tolerate that. And we voted for it. We voted for it to, you know, can these technologies help us end open air drug markets? Can they help us end the random attacks? The last example, going back to the commercial one, is, you know, San Francisco is becoming a commercial retail ghost town. That's certainly about people not coming back to the office, right? That story, and we have our highest downtown vacancy rate, blah, blah. But it's also, shoplifting and California, some of the reforms in California over the last 5 to 10 years have been a major part of that. There was a Whole Foods in a transitional neighborhood on Market Street that lasted for about a year. And the list of people with mental issues who would come in with bats and pipes and attack and shoplift and attack employees was just out of control. You see these videos on TikTok of organized shoplifters, you know, rolling into Walgreens and you know, taking what they want, or a jewelry store, and leaving. And so we're seeing a lot. So the stores that are here are turning to these new technologies. They're installing them that track track the face of everyone entering the store, compare it to a database of known shoplifters, of people even doing some pattern recognition, I think, on people, is prediction, you know, does this person have a higher possibility according to our algorithm of causing trouble in our store, of being a potential being a potential criminal. And so I think, I mean, lots of ways that we're starting to see these technologies, these tools of surveillance, you know, not just for these emergencies, quote unquote emergencies, but really becoming normalized.
Well, as the events of insurrection go from being in the future to becoming the present, the obvious question, which I've been saving the whole time, is what comes next? And I specifically ask, because you alluded to this earlier, there are acts of resistance in insurrection. There is, of course, at the end, there's alluded to that they are jamming communication tools. There are the drag queens who are assisting deserters. Early on, there's, I believe it's municipal workers, try to sabotage the cable cars because they're being used by occupying troops, as a sign of that one. We've seen early signs of this. In addition to protests in Portland and in Chicago, there is the woman who was, two people were indicted for basically ramming the car and being shot by ICE agents in Chicago. There is discussion I've seen about the Boogaloo, they're generally considered far right-wing provocateurs who are trying to bring about an American civil war. There's a lot of discussion. The president's special advisor, Stephen Miller, has very much taken to social media, claiming that anyone, from judges to normal protesters, are illegally launching an insurrection against the president's authority. What form do you think resistance will take? Because that's one thing we have not seen to a degree yet, and I'm scared about what forms it might take. But beyond simply protests and standing off with troops, what was your basis there for perhaps sabotage, or perhaps deserters, or where what are the signs you're looking for next? What are the weak signals that are on the ground now for the next 10 months?
You know, one way that my scenario is a little different from what we've seen, it goes a little farther beyond, is that I imagine it as a longer term occupation. I mean, we've seen, you know, a longer term and a more pervasive citywide kind of occupation. You know, we've seen, of course, you know, troops have been in LA. Troops are just now starting to leave LA. Troops, National Guard troops, are just now starting to leave DC. But they were never really kind of, you know, deeply embedded in neighborhoods. And, you know, people's the lives of most people in these cities did not change day to day. And that's something that I did kind of imagine, you know, maybe jumping the gun a little bit, but that's something I did imagine, that as more people are affected, the more people that are affected, the more resistance you're going to see, the more everyday acts of resistance you're going to see. I've been really, I don't want to say, maybe impressed, surprised to see that, you probably heard about this too, that grand juries in D.C. are, as I understand this, they rubber stamp, for the most part, traditionally they rubber stamp any indictment. Grand juries in D.C. were rejecting them left and right. The person who threw a sandwich at an agent, I can't remember who it was, but right, they threw that out. They rejected charge after charge after charge, and a lot of people started to see this is civil. This is an emergent act of civil disobedience. We have a jury of our, we have a legal system based on of our peers, and our peers are acting, and they are resisting, and they are fighting. And so I'm inspired. I'm hopeful to see that. I mean, I think we are, you know, you didn't ask me, we haven't talked about what this might mean next year. I've been surprised at the speculation. I've been surprised at not only the kinds of speculation, but where you see this speculation about what all these troops in these cities and normalizing it, particularly, what does that mean for the midterms next year, right? And I don't want to, and I've been surprised, we're not just talking about fringe corners of the internet talking about this conspiracy between the connection between the, you know, swaying the midterms and troops in cities. We're seeing this, I mean, Rachel Maddow, we go from like fringes of the internet to Rachel Maddow, all the way to the op-ed section of the New York Times. This is where we are regularly seeing this.
Well, forms of resistance. I mean, yes, the Overton window is wide open and bats are flying out of it right now, for sure. But yes, but back to what forms what urban resistance might take. Because of course, again, being an architecture and urbanism podcast, like urban warfare is not something I want to entertain, but I am sort of curious. I mean, you know, there's a long history of barricades. There's a long history of going back to the 60s of rioting. I mean, it's always interesting is that as perhaps some might call us all alarmists on this podcast. And I've had, like, my uncle, for example, told me, like, yes, compared to the violence of 68, 69, like, we still have not seen anything like it in terms of the hundreds of cities that saw physical violence. But I'm curious, like, does it take that form again, given the various forms of culture jamming and hacking and various forms? I just, for example, saw, I guess 50 people in San Francisco just created the first distributed denial of service act with Waymos, where they brought 50 Waymos to the longest dead end in San Francisco and left them stranded there. People are immediately speculating, like, well, what if we did this with ice vehicles where you jam in ice by calling in Waymos and things like this? I think this might be a little too rose-colored glasses given the control of these technologies, but I am curious, like, how does it get weirder this time, perhaps?
Right. Well, I mean, when I said earlier, it's, you know, when, not if, troops come to San Francisco, right? I mean, in our population here, we have a latent technical ability that is higher than, you know, technical, you know, knowledge and capacity that is higher than most average American cities, right? I think it's going to be maybe I'm sounding a little too giddy, but I'm kind of excited to see what it's going to mean. One of the artifacts I didn't get a chance to make was an underground gathering of coders, right? Meeting in a safe house, planning on how to hack the infrastructure, how to hack the networks, the communication technologies, all the logistics and the infrastructure of a deployment of an occupation in the city. And, you know, we haven't seen that yet. I mean, in Portland, we have the frog suits. We have, you know, Portland, keep Portland weird. So we have, you know, their skill is weirdness. Our skill might be technical. You know, this, you know, we have, when you send troops to occupy AI, a city that is abundant with AI engineers, you're going to see some cool shit happen in terms of that resistance. And so maybe I'm looking forward to it. You know, there was, I don't know, time-wise, there was, I printed out, I did my homework for this, but there was one quote that really stuck with me. And you've probably heard, she's been quoted everywhere this year, Barbara Walter, political scientist at UC San Diego, right? And she's the author of a book called How Civil Wars Start. I think it published a couple of years ago. But obviously, in the last year, you know, she is everywhere. And this was a New York Times column, October 7th, Thomas Edsel. And he asked her, you know, do you think Trump, Miller, and other allies are hoping to provoke violence in order to justify further punitive or repressive policies? And her short answer was yes. Yeah, provoking violence is a common way to do this. Then he asked her, is this working? And this is a quote from her. The quickest way to piss people off is to send soldiers into their neighborhoods, especially when there's no reason for them to be there. It's inherently provocative, and Trump and his team understand this. Research by the political scientist Robert Pape shows that the single most powerful predictor of suicide terrorism is the presence of foreign troops on local soil. People hate that. They hate the humiliation, the powerlessness, the feeling of being occupied, right? And that struck me. We are, holy crap, we're talking about, you know, this is research that was probably done in Iraq, right? In Afghanistan, in places where, you know, U.S. troops came and were not welcome, right? This is research drawing from that, and we're talking now about the context of suicide. We're putting the dots together of suicide bombers, suicide terrorism, and American streets because the occupying force are National Guard troops who are likely to be, you know, your neighbors from, you know, fellow residents of your state or even your city. I mean, that is, if I can say this, that's batshit bonkers that we are on this timeline right now that we're talking about suicide bombers on American streets acting against American troops sent there on dubious legality. I mean, I'm a futurist. I'm a designer. I don't necessarily have more to comment to say about that other than just, wow. I mean, this is a timeline. This is a future. I mean, call that a weak signal, if you will. But, whew, I don't know where we go from there. But it's something we may very likely see in the next year.
This is where I'll note for listeners that there's a phrase in the foresight business known as abyss gaze, which of course gets quoted back to Nietzsche, that when you gaze into an abyss, the abyss gazes back into you. And it's always a thin line between being able to look very clearly at potential futures and then wondering how it affects you when you think about it in that regard. Dan, I'll leave the last question to you. I do want to hear, Jason, what your next project is in this. You have not created a sequel to this per se, but you have been using the technique to further think about sort of civic futures in this regard. So would love to hear about your next work. But Dan, if you want to interject first.
No interjection. I'm just sort of picturing how some of the facilities that were already being critiqued as being anti-urban could become that much more so out of justification to resist being invaded by protesters or perhaps even, suicide bombers. I mean, it could be that, you know, it's not just the federal buildings, but it's anything that's deemed to be important. It could be a very weird construction boom at the same time that we're trying to debrutalize, civic infrastructure. That would be quite an ironic thing to have happen, as well as tragic. I'm just thinking about even in San Francisco, where you've taken down freeways and you've removed barriers and boulevarded streets at the same time, you know, during that same period, you know, you had the federal building erected by Morphosis Architects, which is quite fortress-like. And one would think that if there continues to be justification or manufactured justification, you will see more of this type of architecture in direct competition with the sort of Jan Gehl style, more urbanistic approach. So that's where my mind is going, in addition to all the crazy stuff, that it would be more chaotic and immediate.
It's true. The American years of lead will definitely leave their mark on the city, that's for sure, in terms of how it's represented. But yeah.
Well, and I was even hoping, I didn't necessarily have the most creative answers to the question, but I was still hoping that we might even explore the terrain of how do we, if this truly becomes normalized in both Democratic and Republican and Democratic administrations, right? If troops operating domestically, you know, becomes normalized, how does urban design change? How do not only, you know, at an infrastructural level, how do we redesign cities differently, especially if a city, you know, a blue city is preparing, you know, or rebuilding in a future where troops are regularly deployed there. What does that mean? But even like, what are we going to see in terms of like, I mean, you know, Portland, Seattle, we've had these like homemade, this kind of like a homemade guerrilla infrastructure of protests, of resistance. So on both those levels, if this becomes normalized, I mean, if this is our American future for the next, you know, couple of decades, how does city design change? How does civic life change? I would love to explore that and talk about that. Greg, can I answer your question about?
Yeah, this is the place to end then. So going back to, again, sort of the civic foresight, because there's a lot of stuff also with both, of course, you know, it's like a hallmark of foresight that, like, you know, the goal is not to predict the future. The goal is to basically train the audience, the workshop crowd, how to be better at reconnoitering the future and opening up their imagination to possible futures that may happen. We all do it. I don't know if we ever succeed at it. I'm curious your latest on this, particularly using generative AI, because there's been groups like Urbanist AI out of Finland and others about doing rapid co-creation with audiences using these kinds of tools about how can we put futures into the hands of people who can rapidly do mock-ups in the way that we couldn't before, in the same way you were talking about. So what's your follow-up project to this? And yeah, how do you expect to continue the discipline part?
Yeah. Really quickly, the follow-up project, I was following the very rapid passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act through Congress this spring, right? Through the House, Senate, back to the House, back to the Senate. And what you know, I set aside whatever my political leanings, any disagreement I may have with the provisions of the bill, and I do have you know, my fair share. I was most struck by how few Americans had heard of the bill, were tracking it, right? On the day that Trump signed it into law, July 4th, you know, symbolic day for signing this into law, a majority of Americans had still not heard of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, right? One of the most seismic, massive pieces of legislation in, you know, at least a generation. And so that was, as a futurist, as a speculative designer, as a storyteller, I saw an opportunity. Like, this is to create an accessible, to translate this, what, 900-page bill into stories, to humanize it, to tell stories about, you know, across the political spectrum, across partisan, nonpartisan think tanks and groups. You know, there's pretty much wide consensus that, you know, 14 million Americans are going to lose health insurance, that 4 million of, you know, let's fudging the numbers, American families with children are going to lose food assistance, right? There's not a lot of debate about this, but there was very little awareness of it. And so that's the opportunity I saw as a storyteller. You know, and since a lot of these impacts we're not going to see immediately, they're not immediate impacts, they're impacts that are going to hit over the next, from 2026 to 2035, I thought, let's visualize it. So the follow-up project is called One Big Beautiful Aftermath. And it follows the same, it's again, even more photojournalistically inspired, even more rigorously grounded in lots and lots of nonpartisan, credible, highly esteemed analysis and reporting about every aspect of the bill and projections about the bill. But 10 very, very, very deeply, as I said earlier, I've built hundreds in my career, hundreds of just, you know, postcards from the future, right? Ranging from, you know, a little sticker to a massively, you know, like a diorama, right? These are the 10 most raw, real, visceral, human images I've ever been able to create. And that is, I mean, I'll be honest, that is in large part thanks to, you know, the advancing AI capabilities. I gotta step in and say, again, with dozens, dozens, and dozens of hours of you know, handcrafted meticulous refinement, right? But I'm still grappling, you know, the fact that I can, I will go back to this site and look at it. You know, even now, I mean, I created it and I can still, you know, shed a tear looking at the teacher who is opening up the snack drawer, the secret snack drawer, to get a granola bar for her student who came in hungry because her family lost food assistance, right? That story still, you know, punches me in the gut. And, you know, that's what I want to work on. I can give a very last plug. My last one, 120th Congress. That will be the next Congress that is sworn into office on January 2027. You know, this will be the Congress that results from the midterms next year. I want to explore, I guess, basically kind of two paths. If Republicans retain control, what legislation might they be holding, have held back? What legislation might we be likely to see in the last 2 years of the Trump presidency, in the next Congress, if Republicans retain complete control of the government? But at the same time, you know, what might it look like if Democrats are able to retake one or both houses? And again, just the way you hear the midterms, most people on the street hear the word midterms. I mean, it's not, it doesn't affect their lives. They don't, I mean, they're not dumb. They know what they are, but it doesn't affect their lives. They're not tracking it. And that's where the storytelling, that's where the future, talking about near future, you know, possibilities for the future, impacts for the future, consequences of the, you know, what are the consequences of the barrage of headlines that happen, you know, hour by hour by hour these days? If I can help humanize, make those consequences accessible through stories, through anything, then that will be a good day's work. And then that will be a mission, a personal mission that I can be happy with.
Jason, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. It has been enlightening and unnerving, as we expected it to be. And well, I look forward to a future in which we can better predict the future and hopefully we have better outcomes, thanks to people like yourselves.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for this. This is a great discussion. Thank you very much.